You're listening to Nick Espinoza here on the Deep Dive Radio Show on Huntley Community Radio, WHRULP, on 101.5 FM.
Moving on, let's talk about the IRS. And this is one of our finalies. And I think I'm going to give you a finally that you're probably not necessarily going to care about or kind of put a smile on your face. And you're going to get another one here that's going to horrify you. And the first one is on the IRS. Now, here's what's going on. In June, basically the news outlet ProPublica published a report after allegedly obtaining years worth of private tax records from several high-profile individuals, including Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos, Tesla CEO Elon Musk, billionaire investor Carl Icahn, and more. Now, the publication came to the conclusion that these incredibly wealthy individuals are able to pay a low tax rate compared to the growth in their wealth and incomes. And in some case, the quote-unquote true tax rate of the nation's wealthiest individuals was close to nothing. Now, the tax data was widely reported and used as a basis for proposals in Congress to increase taxes on the wealthiest Americans. I know that Senator Elizabeth Warren basically took this report and completely went to town on the Senate floor with this. And this is what we're talking about. And you may say, okay, they're clearly not paying their fair share. And quite frankly, I agree with you. As a business owner myself, and I am not Jeff Bezos money or Carl Icahn money or Elon Musk money, I pay a good chunk of taxes, and in some cases, after reading this, I realize I'm probably paying more than some of these people, and I am not making that level of shoot me into space kind of cash. And so by virtue of that, it is absolutely infuriating, but a data breach is a data breach. A leak is a leak. And for whatever reason, you know, people want to keep this information private. You know, people went after the former president for this, and I agree he should have released his tax returns. I think that should be law if you're running for the highest office in the land. But as private citizens, Bezos, Musk, and Icahn shouldn't have their information out there, even if it's damning. Now, I understand this is the balance between, basically having this information, let's say, via a whistleblower versus them, let's say, getting away with something. I understand and I recognize that. But this is a fine line to walk, and I think this is an actual debate. I don't think I have a solid answer for this, because my first and foremost thought is I would want my data protected. I'm not running for any office. While I may be public by virtue of owning a private corporation, or, you know, because I'm public because of this radio show, or maybe you've seen me on television at some point or something along those lines, I don't want my information out there. It's not yours to have. At the same token, if I'm seriously breaking the law, there you go. So I'm very curious to hear thoughts on that, but I think it's an important one to discuss. And the last finally we have, and I'm sure some of you are smiling that Bezos and Musk's tax returns got out there and we can all basically be angry at them for not paying taxes the way they should. I'm not denying anybody that for the record, but this last one is not going to put a smile on your face, because we have to talk about the targeting of journalists and activists worldwide. And holy cow on this one. This one blew my mind. I did a very long, extensive dive on this, on my Breaches of the Week video, where I do that every Sunday, a video and podcast every Sunday. And I really went to town on this one because, wow, here's what's going on. Military grade spyware licensed by an Israeli firm to governments for tracking terrorists and criminals was used in an attempted and successful hacks of at least 37 smartphones belonging to journalists, human rights activists, business executives, and two women close to the murdered Saudi journalist Kamal Khashoggi, according to an investigation by the Washington Post and 16 of its media partners. Now, the phones appear on a list of more than 50,000 numbers that are concentrated in countries known to engage in surveillance of their citizens and also known to have been clients of the Israeli firm NSO Group, a worldwide leader in the growing and largely unregulated private spyware industry, according to the Washington Post and their colleagues' investigation. Now, the list does not identify who put the numbers on it or why, and it is unknown of basically unknown how many of these phones were targeted or surveilled, but forensic analysis of those 37 smartphones showed that many displayed a tight correlation between timestamps associated with a number on the list and the initiation of surveillance, in some cases as brief as a few seconds. Now, Forbidden Stories, a Paris-based journalism nonprofit, and Amnesty International, basically working in, obviously, in conjunction with the Washington Post, Amnesty International being a human rights group, had access to the list and shared it with these news organizations, which then did further research and analysis. Amnesty's security lab did forensic analysis on the smartphones. Now, the numbers on the list are unattributed, but reporters were able to identify more than 1,000 people spanning more than 50 countries through research and interviews on four continents. So we're talking several Arab royal family members, at least 65 business executives, 85 human rights activists, 189 journalists, and more than 600 politicians and government officials, including cabinet ministers, diplomats, military and security officers as well. The numbers of several heads of state and prime ministers were also on that list. Among the journalists who numbers appear on this list, which dates to 2016, are reporters working overseas for several leading news organizations, including a small number from CNN, the Associated Press, Voice of America, the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Bloomberg, Le Monde in France, the Financial Times in London, and Al Jazeera in Qatar. Now, the targeting of these 37 smartphones would appear to conflict with the stated purpose of NSO's licensing of the Pegasus spyware, which is basically what we're talking about, and the company says it's intended only for use in surveilling terrorists and major criminals. The evidence extracted from these smartphones reveals basically that calls into question pledges by NSO group out of Israel to police its clients for human rights abuses, and this is a human right abuse. Now, the media consortium that analyzed the list through interviews and forensic analysis of these phones and basically compared details with previous reported information about NSO, which is how they arrived at this. Amnesty Security Lab examined 67 smartphones where attacks were suspected. Of those, 23 were successfully infected, and 14 showed signs of attempted penetration. And there's your 37 phones. In lengthy responses, NSO called the investigation's findings exaggerated and baseless. It also said it does not operate the spyware licensed to its clients and, quote, has no insight, end quote, into the specific intelligence activities of their clients. Now, NSO describes its customers as 60 intelligence, military, and law enforcement agencies in 40 countries, although it will not confirm the identities of any of their clients, citing confidentiality obligations. The consortium found many of these phone numbers in at least 10 country clusters, which were subjected to deeper analysis, and that would be Azerbaijan, Bahrain, Hungary, India, Kazakhstan, Mexico, Morocco, Rwanda, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE, or United Arab Emirates. Citizen Lab also found evidence that all 10 have been clients of NSO, according to Bill Marzak, which is a senior research fellow at the security lab researching this. Now, for the record, here's how Pegasus works. And heads up, iPhone users, because quite frankly, there is this common misconception that iPhones are super secure and can never be broken. And this blows that out of the water. I've said this for years on air and in my daily work, but here we are. So here's how Pegasus works. First, let's start with the target. Someone sends what is known as a trap link to a smartphone that persuades the victim to tap or activate basically that link, or it can activate itself without any input, as in the most sophisticated zero-click hacks, meaning as if it's on your phone, it can self-activate due to its interaction with the phone, and you don't even have to basically interact with it to make it work. Now, here's what the infection does. The spyware captures and copies the phone's most basic functions. That's according to NSO's own marketing materials. Things like recording from the cameras and microphones to collecting location data, call logs, and contacts. Now, these are basically tactics and techniques that we've used in cybersecurity when we are assessing a corporation that has paid us and has signed off on us infecting them to go ahead and look at things like this. But obviously, this is getting out of hand, as NSO says we don't know what they're doing beyond, you know, them promising only to look at terrorists or whatever. Now, it's doing all of that. So basically, it's collecting that location data, also call logs and contacts, all that kind of stuff. Now, On the tracking side of things, this basically implant secretly reports that information, basically reports the information on your phone to an operative who can then use it to map out the sensitive details of your life. So imagine if you're that, you know, head of state and this is on your phone, they're going to see everything. Messages you send, locations you go is all there, and it's flying under the radar. Now, Pegasus is engineered to evade defenses on both iPhones and Androids, heads up iPhone users, and basically to leave very little trace of its attack or infection. Now, familiar privacy measures like strong passwords and encryption are basically no defense against Pegasus, which can attack phones without warning, or rather without any warning to the users. It can read anything on the device that a user can, also steal photos, recordings, locations, communications, passwords if you're typing them in, all that kind of stuff, call logs. It can steal social media posts or direct messages that are private on social media platforms, not to mention direct messages as well outside of social media. The spyware can also activate cameras and microphones for real-time surveillance. This is something that, like as I've mentioned, has been there for quite some time, but this is something that is now targeting major players in the world, whether it's world leaders or high-end business executives. This is basically intelligence operations getting this without having to do the work themselves, getting this onto these devices, and then essentially going to town recording everything. This is a huge problem. This is a massive privacy violation, and it's going on basically right now. Obviously, NSO is, you know, denying this, saying, hey, no, this isn't us. But obviously, the research is the research from, you know, almost 20 different outlets, 16 or 17 media publication news organizations looking at this, not to mention Amnesty International and everything else. So this is a huge problem. We'll see where this goes. I wanted to end with this because this is almost like a mini deep dive on this, but we'll get to the deep dive next. But wow, this was crazy. So those were your breaches of the week, or the last couple of weeks anyway. Were you affected? Let me know.
You're listening to Nick Espinoza here on the Deep Dive Radio Show on Huntley Community Radio, WHRULP, on 101.5 FM. And now for the Deep Dive segment, where we take a closer and deeper look at a cybersecurity, cyber warfare, or technology issue around us. And if you have any suggestions for a Deep Dive segment or something you'd like me to dive into, you can once again find me on Facebook and Twitter at Nick A. ESP. Again, that's Nick A. ESP. Or you can send an email to questions@securityfanatics.com. That's questions@securityfanatics.com. I am more than happy to take a look at it. And if it meets our standards, we are more than happy to do a deep dive on it. So let's begin.
And this week's deep dive is actually something that's kind of near and dear to me, in the sense that I've talked about this off and on before, and that's the difference between biometrics and passwords. But we have some new information that's kind of put this into perspective in a way that really just wasn't before. And so with that, I'm asking the question, just how private are you with your Face ID or your fingerprint? And here's what's going on, because this is coming from TechCrunch, but I have actually done a lot of homework on this for you guys here today. And I want to just lay all of this out, because I think a lot of people really don't understand the difference between things like encryption, passwords, biometric identifiers, and everything else. And so the beginning of this is essentially the backdrop for where I want to go. And it's coming from TechCrunch. And they're reporting that a federal judge in Washington, D.C. has ordered a man accused of participating in the U.S. Capitol riot on January 6th to unlock his laptop with quote-unquote his face, after prosecutors argued that the laptop likely contained video footage that would incriminate him in the attempted insurrection. Now, the guy we're talking about is actually named Guy Reffitt, and he was arrested in late January, 3 weeks after he participated in the riot, and has been in jail ever since. He pled not guilty to 5 federal charges, including bringing a firearm to the Capitol grounds, and also a charge of obstructing justice. His Windows laptop was one of several devices that were seized by the Federal Bureau of Investigation, or FBI, which investigators said was basically protected with a password, but could also be unlocked using Reffitt's face. Prosecutors said forensic evidence suggested that the laptop contained gigabytes of footage from Reffitt's helmet-worn camera that he allegedly used to record some of the riot. Basically, I think he probably just stuck a GoPro on his riot helmet and you know, got into the fray of this, and the GoPro obviously captured a lot of everything, including his movements on that day. Now, prosecutors asked the court if it could compel Reffitt to sit down in front of his computer to unlock it. Now, Reffitt's lawyer told the court that his client, quote-unquote, could not remember the password, but the court sided with the government and granted the motion to compel his biometrics. Reffitt's lawyer told CNN, which first reported on this court order, that the laptop is now unlocked. Therefore, law enforcement has access to anything on there, including footage from, let's say, his GoPro or whatever camera he was carrying on his head that day. The government took advantage of a loophole in the Fifth Amendment, which grants anyone in the United States the right to remain silent, including the right not to turn over information that could implicate them in a crime, such as a password. Meaning, if that password is used to unlock something that has, let's say, information that implicates you in a crime, you are not compelled under the Fifth Amendment to turn that over. But some of the courts have ruled that those protections don't extend to a person's physical attributes that can be used in place of a password, such as a face scan or a fingerprint. Think about that. Now, in Reffitt's indictment, the FBI said as much, arguing that compelling Reffitt to unlock his computer by sitting in front of it, quote, would not run afoul of the defendant's Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination. Courts across the United States are still divided on basically the reading of the Fifth Amendment and whether it applies to the compelled use of a person's biometrics. The U.S. Supreme Court isn't likely to address this issue anytime soon, though, because it just rejected two petitions in 2 years to rule on this exact matter, which leaves it up to the lower courts, meaning the lower federal courts and state courts, basically to decide this as we go along. So we have this hodgepodge, essentially, of rulings, and when you get to a slightly higher court than, let's say, the local court, you have either a yes or no answer on the Fifth Amendment when it comes to biometrics, but nothing is clear. And this is where we have basically an issue that needs discussing. So, for example, I have a really strong password on my mobile phone. It would be a total pain to have to type that in every single time I wanted to open my phone just to look at the screen. So, like, virtually everyone who uses a stronger than a 4-digit PIN on their phone basically uses a fingerprint or their face to open their phone. I'm no different in that sense. I use that biometric. I don't use my face, but I do use a fingerprint. Now, while this is very convenient for me, what is clear is that it doesn't fully protect me in the court system that we just discussed this person sitting there on January 6th. Now, consider this rather long quote from the Congressional Research Service, who you can find basically at crsreports.congress.gov. That's right. This is an official research paper, basically from the government, and it is basically entitled, it's regarding biometrics. And I quote, obtaining a warrant to search a smartphone or other electronic data-containing device does not guarantee that law enforcement can access the device's data. However, as such devices, quote, can be and often are encrypted, end quote. And decryption frequently requires entering a password or increasingly using a biometric identifier such as a fingerprint or facial scan. When a warrant is obtained to search a protected device, the question becomes whether a suspect or ostensible owner of the device can be compelled to furnish the password or biometric identifier needed to access the device's data. Courts in recent years have had to grapple with whether compulsion in such cases would violate the Fifth Amendment's self-incrimination clause, which provides that, and I quote, or subquote, I guess, no person shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself. Courts have reached conflicting conclusions as to whether and when the compelled decryption of a password or biometric identifier protected device runs afoul of the Fifth Amendment. And perhaps counterintuitively, the trend appears to favor recognizing more constitutional protection for password-protected devices than for the devices protected by a biometric identifier. Now, interestingly enough, as I'm reading this, I'm thinking to myself, I don't think the courts necessarily understand how biometrics are applied. Oftentimes, they are used in lieu, of that strong encrypted password, but oftentimes they can be tied together. But what raises an alarm for me is another passage in this exact report from this research report from Congress, and I quote, "Yet, if the government can show that it already knows of the existence and the suspect's possession of the documents at issue, i.e., that these matters are a foregone conclusion, and thus that the factual assertions implicit in the act of production add, quote, little or nothing to the sum total of the government's information, then no Fifth Amendment right is touched because the question is not of testimony, but of surrender." Now, as an example of this, and this is what they have there, in Fisher v. the United States, the Supreme Court applied this so-called foregone conclusion exception to determine that the Fifth Amendment did not protect taxpayers from having to produce certain tax documents their accountants had prepared, as the government already knew from the accountants that the papers existed and were in the possession of the taxpayer. And to the crux of this specific situation, this is the current position of the courts and therefore the government, although obviously because it's in the lower courts, this may change sooner than later. And I quote, "These courts have viewed compelled decryption using biometric identifiers as permissible regardless of what the government knows or indeed whether it knows anything at all, because merely exposing a physical feature to a locked electronic device does not require use of, quote, the contents of one's own mind to communicate a statement of fact." Basically, what they're saying is that if you put your finger on your phone to unlock your device or put your face in front of it, basically, that doesn't require the court to compel you to think about what's on your phone. So I don't have to think about the contents of my phone, basically, if I just happen to put my finger on it and unlock it, or I happen to basically have my face in front of it and unlock it in that way. So we can look at the case I first talked about here as an example of this. Guy Reffitt didn't have to think about the possibly incriminating evidence stored in his laptop in order to open it by simply putting his face in proximity of the camera on his laptop. He didn't even have to physically touch the laptop. He just had to be in the vicinity where the camera could recognize him. But here's the thing. And this is why I'm really bringing this up. Most Americans, myself included, were appalled, just appalled by the events of January 6th. But I am not sitting here saying if Mr. Reffitt is guilty or innocent. I am not adjudicating that. I honestly think that's for the courts to decide via all available evidence. What I am talking about here is the compulsion of the innocent for self-incrimination. Now, assume for a moment that Guy's laptop had no information on it that would incriminate him directly, but it could incriminate others. Others he didn't want to testify against for whatever reason. Maybe they're his friends, his family, whatever that is. What happens then? Did we just violate his rights and make him a de facto witness against, let's say, others, whether he wanted to be or not, without that compulsion by the court? Now, what if I personally am pulled over by the police and for whatever reason, they incorrectly believe I'm up to no good, like I'm going to go do a crime or something like that, or they think I fit the description of a suspect or something along those lines. By nature of my actual job in cybersecurity, and as much as I love doing this radio show, I do have a day job that pays the bills, and that is cybersecurity. My phone is always encrypted, and I have access to sensitive client information on it. That's my job. If I need to get into something and let's say I have to pull over on the road and open up my phone and get into a, you know, client's data because there's an emergency, I have the ability to do that. And by virtue of that, my phone is very, very heavily encrypted and secured for compliance. I have a lot of threat detection on it, et cetera, et cetera. Now, by default, because of that, I am not inclined to willingly give law enforcement access to my phone. Not because I don't want to cooperate with law enforcement. I actually sometimes work with law enforcement, and local law enforcement and federal law enforcement have hired me to do things before, in terms of cybersecurity. So it's not because I don't want to cooperate with, you know, the police officer, but because I have other innocent interests to protect, namely the sensitive compliant data for my clients, I don't want to comply with that. And that is my right under the Fifth Amendment. So do you see where I'm going with this? It's really easy to say, like, let's say in the case of Guy Reffitt, you know, if you are looking at that entire case and obviously just January 6th in general, that of course the government should be able to unlock his phone, especially when we're pretty dang sure that the person is guilty. But we're also pretty dang sure, basically, that we shouldn't when it's clearly an innocent device, an innocent person with valid reasons not to open their device, meaning I'm an innocent person, and it's clearly they shouldn't be having to force me to unlock my phone in any which way, shape, or form, whether it's a biometric identifier like a face or a finger or me punching in my password. But we can't have it both ways. We can't. I'm all for the prosecution of those who perpetrated January 6th. And if Mr. Reffitt or Guy Reffitt is guilty of that and the courts find that, I will accept that. I am not, though, for having basically that group of people ruin the privacy laws for the rest of us. And that's a huge problem that we have. As we make the lowest common denominator choices in our law, the vast majority of us are appalled by that. The vast majority of us aren't out there committing crimes. But when we have situations like this, this is what gives the government that in to basically create a law that says, yes, you have to be compelled. And I think the courts need to clearly decide where this falls so we can take appropriate measures in our lives. I don't think the Supreme Court should be punting this ball. It should not be passing on these things. We are living in the technological age. And by virtue of that, we are using more sophisticated ways to easily secure our devices, but also easily open them as well. And if we don't have those kinds of protections, then we are, I think, violating the amendments. We're violating, in this case, the Fifth Amendment.
And thank you so much for tuning in this week. It was another fun show, and I think we covered a lot of really good stuff, and I hope you guys enjoyed it as much as I did. It was a really good time, and I hope you keep tuning in. Thank you very much for listening to the Deep Dive Radio Show here with Nick Espinoza. And if you have any comments, suggestions, questions, absolutely anything, once again, you can find me on Facebook and Twitter at Nick AESP. Again, that's Nick AESP. And you can always send an email to questions@securityfanatics.com. Don't be shy. I love the feedback. We've been having a great time with the show. And as always, stay safe and stay online, everyone. Thanks for listening.